It was tempting to start asking questions, to lead Danny to her own conclusions about her condition. But Charlotte didn't want to ruin the surprise for her. She figured she had about 2 weeks before Danny came in for an exam. Later, as she organized her equipment in the clinic's designated prenatal room, Charlotte decided she would shelve all thoughts of Danny's treatment plans in the same place where she stored the muddlesome puzzle of Leonard O'Donnell. Will had set her up in the largest exam room, not just to make the expecting mothers more comfortable, but because there was always the possibility of patients shifting into large-scale animals while freaking out during an exam. Still, Charlotte wasn't sure there was enough room for a full-size dragon, and she was 100% sure she didn't want to find out. She was excited, and yet a little terrified, as she gave the exam room one last cleaning. "The newlyweds!" she exclaimed, as Jillian knocked on the doorframe. "Good morning." Jillian looked flushed and happy, exactly how you'd expect a bride to look post-honeymoon, just a little more pregnant. And Bael was every inch the doting new husband and expectant father. What Charlotte didn't expect was for Zed to follow them into the exam room, shutting the door behind him. Charlotte lifted her dark brow. "Mayor Barrand, did you have some questions for me? This appointment is really just for Jillian and her birthing partner."
"Technically, I'm here in my mayoral capacity. It's not good for the citizens for a panicky dragon father to be rampaging through the bayou. Also, I'm the one who will be getting you out to the birthing site, so Jillian thought it would be a good idea for me to sit in."
Charlotte looked to Jillian for confirmation, only to receive a brilliant grin. The midwife shrugged. "You're in charge here, Dr. Ramsay."
"Any instructions for me?"
Bael asked, swallowing heavily as he eyed the ultrasound machine. "Try to relax," Charlotte replied. "The more comfortable you are with me now, the better off we'll be when you're in dragon form. I do not look good surrounded by reptilian flames."
"It's not that bad,"
Zed assured her. Jillian shot the mayor an incredulous look, and Zed added,
"Well, I don't want to scare her."
Charlotte went about the business of her normal patient intake. Bael and Zed had to duck out at several points to give Jillian privacy, but they handled it with good humor. Jillian was in remarkably good health for someone who worked as hard as she did in a high-stress position. Of course, Jillian also vomited blue lava on occasion, so Charlotte supposed everything balanced out in the end. Almost self-consciously, Charlotte laid a hand on an old leather-bound journal on the counter. While she'd rejected the magic books, Lizzie had loaned Charlotte her ancestors' diaries for her travels. Granny Una had dealt with all sorts of supernatural pregnancies when she moved to the New World. Like had a way of recognizing like back then, and all magic mothers knew Una Popescu's kitchen was a safe haven for all pregnant females, no matter what the species. Una kept careful records of her patients, the strange quirks and perils of their pregnancies, and how she'd handled them. It had provided an invaluable guide to the women in Charlotte's family. "So I'll be honest, I've delivered dragon babies and I've delivered phoenix babies, but I've never delivered a hybrid of the two," she told them. "And I have never delivered a giant metal egg for a non-dragon before. But no one else has either, to my knowledge. I'm approaching this in the same way I imagine you approached your wedding. We'll take a mix of cues from both of your biologies to make you as comfortable as possible. Anything you don't want, as long as it doesn't create an unsafe situation, we'll do away with it. So, to start, I'm assuming you want the birth to take place in your cave in phoenix form." "Well, I definitely don't want to try to push a giant metal egg out of my human parts," Jillian retorted, making both Zed and Bael cross their legs in their seats. "Agreed. Now, in terms of safety," Charlotte said, "the last phoenix shifter I attended laid her egg in a nest of smoldering coals, and she burst into flames during contractions. So I will be wearing fireproof gear for my own protection."
"Smart," Zed said. "I think we have firefighter gear in the parish hall. You could borrow it."
"Thanks, that's very helpful. Now, let's take a look at the baby," Charlotte said, wheeling the ultrasound cart towards the exam table.
"Do I get to stay for the ultrasound?"
Zed whispered, his eyes going wide.
"Is that all right, Bael?"
"Well, someone has to catch Bael if he passes out. He got a little misty last time," Jillian laughed and squeezed Zed's hand as Charlotte drizzled warm jelly on her stomach. Charlotte turned toward the wall to hide her grin. Zed was going to be downright adorable with his own partner's pregnancy.
"I didn't cry," Bale sniffed. "I had something in my eye."
"Tears, probably,"
Zed said, smirking.
"You want to talk about hair scaling stuff and Dr. Squeakenstein?"
Bale asked.
"No,"
Zed muttered quietly, as Charlotte switched on the ultrasound machine. Technically, Charlotte wasn't a qualified ultrasound tech, but she'd had to learn how to use the equipment herself to protect her patient's privacy. It wasn't like you could go to a regular human prenatal clinic when the scan could show your baby had wings. The room fell silent as the screen lit, showing a black and white crescent with a big, dark oval in the center. Charlotte lifted a brow and pressed the button to listen to the baby's heartbeat. It sounded like a faint gonging sound, a tiny heart thrumming against the metal shell that contained it. Charlotte pressed her lips together, nodding.
"So, that's a big metal egg."
"I have concerns," Jillian said, nodding.
"I thought you were exaggerating,"
Zed marveled.
"It really is a big metal egg."
"I told you, I wasn't being obstinate about a gender reveal party. The baby won't let us get a look at him or her,"
Bale told Zed. Zed snickered.
"The mystery is driving my maman crazy. She's bought so much green yarn, she's about to crowd Mel out of the house. Not that I mind, you know, if Mel has to move out."
"You need to accept that your mother is an adult with a sex life," Jillian told Zed as he literally recoiled across the room. "Kind of a vigorous sex life, if Bonita de los Santos and her famous gossip is to be believed."
"Le diable!"
Zed gasped.
"We agreed never to speak it, Jillian. Never!"
"Jillian, we talked about this,"
Bale told her, even as he smirked.
"Referring to geriatric sexual practices is funny, but not in front of Zed."
"Mel is my honorary father figure and Zed's sort of stepfather," Jillian explained to Charlotte. "He's living with Zed's mom." Bael nodded.
"Relationships can get very complicated in the bayou."
"Well, perplexing family trees aside, you're doing everything you should, pregnancy-wise. I think we're looking at the next 2 weeks or so. Pay attention to your body and what it's telling you. Work as long as you're comfortable." "Ha!" Jillian shot a triumphant look at Bael, who frowned. And then Charlotte added, "As long as you get a sensible amount of rest and fluids and don't overdo it."
"Ha!"
Bael retorted.
"And just so we're clear, Miss Charlotte, who determines what is a reasonable amount of rest, fluids, and overdoing it?"
Charlotte's lips drew back in a frown. "An impartial third party?" Both Jillian and Bael looked to Zed, who mused,
"Probably Sonia. She's the most adult out of all of us.
And she's the only one Jillian will listen to,"
Bael said, nodding. "Me and the giant metal egg are right here," Jillian muttered, pointing to her bump.
"We'll get the cave ready for the birth right away,"
Bael promised Charlotte.
"We'll make it comfortable as possible for you and Jillian." "I'll run you out to the cave when the time comes,"
Zed said.
"Fetch supplies, check up on you every once in a while to make sure you don't need anything."
"It sounds like you've thought this through, which I appreciate. Any other questions?" "I've been having really vivid nightmares," Jillian told her. "A lot of them involve me giving birth to a Jersey Devil-type creature who then disappears into the treasure cave and steals all of Bael's fancy Egyptian art." Charlotte patted her hand. "Well, from what I understand, you have been dealing with some pretty high stress levels lately, like above average potential apocalyptical consequences. I think you're just processing everything now that you know the situation is settled."
"That could be true," Jillian conceded.
"But if you start thinking that you're dreaming something prophetic, let me know," Charlotte insisted. "It's a magique world. Stranger things have happened." That afternoon, Charlotte walked to the pie shop, perfectly happy with her move to Mystic Bayou. Everybody seemed so hopeful here, ready for the future, when the outside world seemed so afraid of it. It was enough to make her consider staying here long term, just so she could be a part of that. She walked into Bath Tilda's Pie Shop, an ancient wood structure with a pressed tin roof and walls painted white and emerald green,
Mismatched cake stands were arranged along the long, polished counter, Siobhan's pie creations on display through the glass domes. Chocolate rhubarb, the strangely mouth-watering house specialty, had a special place on the back, near a mirror veined with gold. The 70s-style looking glass was a bit out of place in the classic diner arrangement, with the weathered green vinyl booths and black-and-white tile floor. But overall, it was welcoming and comfortable. Charlotte scanned the shop. She could only assume the tall, stately woman with the high cheekbones and gold clips in her iron-gray hair was Bathilda. Jillian had told her that Bathilda was one of the few Boone relatives who was neutral in terms of speaking to Bael. While Bathilda didn't attend the wedding, she also didn't do anything to prevent the ceremony, which was more than could be said for some of Bael's uncles. And she'd closed the shop so Siobhan could cover the pie catering. Bathilda stood at the register, filling out forms. Bathilda had a lot of business acumen, Jillian told her, but no real baking skill. She was smart enough to let Siobhan run the kitchen, while she stuck to paperwork and ordering supplies. And apparently it worked, if the crowded shop was any indication. Every seat was filled with people blissfully digging into chocolate rhubarb, lemon meringue, apple crumble, and more. Every seat, that was, except for the one across from Leonard O'Donnell. Despite this being one of the few restaurants in town, she noticed there was no real food on any of the tables. There was bacon served with some of the apple pie, and cheese, and even an arugula salad with what she thought was a pear custard pie, but no full meals. Suddenly, she was wondering how everybody in the bayou was so healthy if all they ate were sweets. She heard a throat clearing to her left from behind the counter. It was nice having other fairy folk around, for no other reason than there were other people around the same height. Siobhan peered into her eyes.
I see you, Zana of the Forest.
Brownie of the Kitchen, Charlotte replied, inclining her head. Siobhan smirked.
My people cover far more than the kitchen.
Charlotte gestured airily. But there are kitchens in so many different places.
Clever,
Siobhan said, narrowing her eyes.
Now what to serve you? You could be a difficult case. I'm going to give you a cherry macaroon pie.
I've never heard of it, but I think I'd be a fool to doubt you. Siobhan lifted a glass dome and cut a large slice of a deep red pie dotted with bits of toasted coconut topping.
Now go over there and sit with the O'Donnell boy, and in a few minutes, I'll come over and you can tell me that's the best thing you've ever eaten.
Oh, I don't know. Leonard might want to have his lunch alone and... Siobhan lifted a small, bony hand to stop her objections.
That's how things are done around here. You share your table. If you want to eat alone, you order to go.
I don't think he likes me very much.
Then he should have ordered his pie to go,
Siobhan told her. Charlotte carried her plate over to Leonard's table, feeling very much like the new girl traversing a middle school cafeteria. She could see his long frame go rigid as she approached, and her heart sank. So far, all of Leonard's reactions to her had been indirect, something she could chalk up to coincidence or misunderstanding. She honestly didn't know how she would get through an outright rejection. Leonard, would you mind if I joined you? He glanced up at her, his dark eyes practically churning with indecision.
Hi, Charlotte.
There was an achingly awkward moment where she seriously considered turning around and eating her pie while standing at the counter. He cleared his throat.
Sure. Have a seat.
She slid into the booth, setting her pie in front of her. But before she could enjoy what was sure to be a pastry gift from the heavens, she wanted to clear the bullshit from the table. Have I done something to offend you?
No, he said, looking startled. Oh, no. Why would you think that?
It's just that I feel like you're avoiding me, and I couldn't help but notice that we were fine until I told you I'm a fae. And if it's because you're uncomfortable around me, I get it. I don't even blame you for it. Some people get uncomfortable around fairies. But I'd rather just get it out in the open so we don't have to dance around it.
I'm so sorry.
He pinched the bridge of his nose.
It's not that. It's that you mentioned cursing when you talked about your abilities. And yeah, it's made me... I'd like to use the word wary, but clearly, I've just been rude. She winced.
So I'm assuming by cursing, you don't mean obscenity. The corners of his generous mouth lifted for a moment.
No. I know it's none of my business, and asking this is...
He swallowed heavily.
Have you ever cursed anybody?
Just once, she said, pinching her lips together. It's not a very pretty story, but trust me when I say he deserved it. A chill seemed to run down his spine, rattling him so hard his teeth chattered. He gripped the edge of the table and took a deep breath. He closed his eyes, and the pity she felt for him bordered on heartbreak. This was the reason she'd only cursed one person in her lifetime. Why her mother had never done it. Not once. Because the ripples of the magic laid on a bloodline never stopped hurting people. The lesson was too heavy, and came at too great a price.
And to make another assumption, that little zing of magic I feel when you're around?
That's not static electricity, is it? He shook his head.
How far back does it go?
1813. He sighed. It's funny that a lot of cursed families don't know exactly when their ancestor messed up on a catastrophic level. But I know the date by heart.
She nodded, cutting into her pie just to give her something to do. That strong magic, to be passed so far down the line? What did your family do to make a fairy that angry?
Leonard sat back in the booth. Well, from what I've been told, we were once considered sort of well-to-do back in Ireland. The family owned a lot of land, were kind to their tenants, and generally well-regarded and productive. But there's a prick in every rosebush, and that was my many-times great-uncle Seamus. I've seen the portrait. Well, the ones that later generations didn't vandalize. He was handsome. Probably would have been considered your classic Prince Charming if he hadn't been such an ass.
You'd be surprised how often the two traits are combined, she told him, taking a bite of pie. The moment the sweet, fruity symphony of flavors hit her tongue, she reached out and grabbed Leonard's hand for support. It was like lying on a bed made with freshly hung linen, the smell of the sun and the wind wafting up from the sheets. It was peace and pleasure all in one.
She opened her eyes and saw she was still holding hands with Leonard across the table. She smiled sheepishly.
Sorry.
It's a fairly common response, he assured her,
though he seemed reluctant to loosen his hold on her fingers. Her hand looked so small in his, but he was cradling it like it was something delicate and precious. She could feel the magic that lived on his skin, as much a part of him as his pores, but it was unnatural and wrong. This wasn't him. This awkward clumsiness was like a pair of shackles holding him back. To his credit, the moment she pulled away, he let go. Charlotte cleared her throat. I'll try to keep the obscene noises to a minimum.
I don't mind so much, he admitted, his cheeks flushing.
When she giggled, he went on with his story.
Anyway, from what my granddad told me, Seamus O'Donnell just loved mocking people he didn't consider quite up to his snuff. People who had less than him, people who weren't as polished. In April 1813, there was a grand party for a young lady who was coming out, one of the other well-to-do families in the county. She tripped over the hem of her gown coming down the stairs into the ballroom, laid flat out on her face for her own party. Poor girl. Well, of course, Seamus started laughing and making stupid jokes about her tripping over her own oversized feet, asking if the musicians had any music fit for a horse to clomp along to. For weeks afterward, he would make whickering noises if he saw her out in town. That sort of thing. What a jackass, she sighed.
I know,
he exclaimed, digging into his own slice of chocolate cream pie. Well, apparently, as rich as they were, the girl's family kept to the old ways, leaving out milk and seeds and pretty stones on their windowsill for the fae folk, building their home with as little iron as possible, singing to the trees whenever they were outside. So their daughter was considered blessed. She had her very own self-appointed fairy godmother, and she didn't appreciate seeing her beloved goddaughter mocked. She knew her goddaughter had only tripped because she was nervous, and she wanted Seamus to know what it was like,
not to be able to control your own body when your stress was high. So, she came to the estate and told him all he had to do was apologize. And of course, he refused, because in his opinion, the young lady in question shouldn't take herself so seriously. The fairy was so angered by his lack of remorse that she cursed him. So that the more nervous he became, the more he fumbled. And because she wanted the whole family to know the injury Seamus had done to her goddaughter's family, ruining what was an important social occasion for them, she cursed the entire line. Oh, and if the O'Donnells tried to do anything to remove the curse, besides Seamus sincerely apologizing, it would get 3 times worse. Oof, that is incredibly clever and insidious, Charlotte marveled, her lips pulling back in a grimace. I mean, I don't want to sound like I admire it, but wow. Come to think of it, she'd never heard of a curse working that way. But she wasn't exactly an expert in this arena. She made a mental note to call her mother, who was much more knowledgeable about these things. As someone who's lived with it for years, I can assure you that it is very effective, he told her. But people here understand. Whenever I drop something, all I have to say is fairy curse, and they just nod and shake their heads and say nothing else. You don't get that out in the real world. Or at least, you didn't before the Poplick monster incident. Anyway, all Seamus had to do was apologize, and the whole family would have had a different destiny. Idiot Seamus didn't believe her, despite her explaining the hows and the whys in great detail in front of his entire family. At first, he wasn't worried. After all, he was so self-assured, he never got nervous. It started off small, dropping something when he was talking to a pretty girl, tripping when he was walking down the street. But it was a crack in his armor, and his nerves got worse, and the accidents got more serious. The family fortunes waned because it takes a steady, clear mind to run a large farm, and it's hard to keep steady when anything could go wrong at any moment. Seamus never repented, even when his family begged him to, because somehow his pride was more important than admitting that he'd done a stupid, cruel thing. Eventually, he was run over in the street by a carriage, and there was a pretty sparse crowd at his funeral. It feels mean to say good, and yet, well, the curse didn't end with him, obviously. The family eventually lost the farm, well before the Great Famine set in. We moved to America, hoping that maybe distance from the Fae would weaken the curse. Well, it took a couple of tries for us to move to America. One of my great-great-uncles fell off the gangway of a steamership to Boston and drowned, and the rest of the family chickened out and went back to Galway for a few years. We managed to eke out a life here, but we've suffered a lot of tragedy along the way. A lot of us end up single because no one wants to date the guy who dumps half a punch bowl on them at the school dance. I guess that's another added smack from the curse. If the bloodline isn't ended by accidental death, we'll blunder our way right out of the gene pool. He was saying it with a lighthearted tone, like he was joking, but she could feel the helpless grief in him. She took his hand again. The static electricity of their touching had been replaced by a pleasant, warm thrum, like the echo of a bell. She very much doubted that Leonard deserved the curse that had been leveled on him, for his empathy alone. But she supposed that was the point of the curse, to teach the O'Donnell line a little compassion for people who were struggling. The curse had done its work. She only wished the original cursing fairy had added a loophole to let more deserving generations out of it. Suddenly, the echo of the bell wasn't just a feeling throughout her body, but a noise coming from her purse. Her phone was chiming. She shot him an apologetic look, but then his phone buzzed as well. He took the phone out of his pocket while she reached for her bag. Her screen showed an email from the League office stating that the department head meeting scheduled for the next day had been moved to that afternoon. In fact, it was scheduled to start in 20 minutes. Oh, for fuck's sake, he grumbled. Watch your language in my restaurant, young man, Bathilda warned him sharply. What is happening? Charlotte asked.
Jessica, my arch nemesis, has moved the department head meeting.
You have an arch nemesis?
Yeah, I know, it sounds weird, he said, pulling a few bills out of his wallet and tucking it under the napkin dispenser.
No, not really. I mean, I think most people have an arch nemesis, real or imagined. They just don't come out and admit it.
Well, I do. And she just moved the department head meeting up 24 hours, which means she's up to something. Either she's counting on me not having the necessary paperwork and agendas prepped so she can embarrass me, or she's planning to have prepped everything herself so she can come out looking like a hero, which is unlikely because I password protected all of the agendas on the shared server, and she doesn't have the information necessary to create her own. And she doesn't know that I prepped and printed everything yesterday and locked the copies in my desk drawer.
Leonard shrugged. She noted that he sprang to his feet, offering his hand, without moving in his usual stiff manner. Charlotte lifted a brow as he went to the counter to tell Siobhan that the meeting had been moved and they would need the usual order that afternoon instead. Siobhan only gave him a confused look as he dashed out of the shop.
I think he's confused,
Siobhan told Charlotte. Charlotte dropped some bills in the tip jar, smiling apologetically. Administrative work involves more espionage activities than I expected.
4. Leonard. Sometimes it paid to be highly organized. The moment he walked into his office and found the meeting agenda still locked in his desk, he knew that Jessica's attempt at a meeting coup failed. Within seconds of his butt hitting his desk chair, she was standing in front of him, seething. Where are the agendas for today's meeting, Leonard?
You mean tomorrow's meeting?
Jessica sniffed. It was moved to this afternoon because of a conflict in Mr. Lancaster's schedule.
That you arranged? Leonard deadpanned.
It's not my fault that you can't keep up with a fast-paced office environment.
Leonard glanced around the empty lobby, where the most active object was a ficus leaf bobbing in a gust of air conditioning. Even in the midst of his confrontation with Jessica, regret and resentment gnawed at his belly. It was Jessica's fault his conversation with Charlotte had been cut short. Despite the otherworldly nature that, frankly, set him on edge, he found he liked the midwife quite a bit. He liked how efficient she was, how she cut to the heart of the matter at hand, how quickly the people he admired trusted her with the most important things in their lives. She had a competence about her that made people want to hand her those things. And if Jessica could just calm the hell down, he might have been able to build a better understanding with her.
It is against league policy to password protect documents on a shared server. You don't have the authorization to hide information from me.
Leonard unlocked the drawer and piled the agendas onto his desk. Then he reached into the top drawer and pulled out a sheet of paper signed by Sonia. Authorization from the Director of Operations to use my discretion to protect information as long as I share it to her private server. Jessica snatched the paper out of his hand and tossed it in the garbage. He rolled his eyes and pulled out another copy, which was laminated.
I also have a digital version saved on my phone. I'll carry those into the meeting room, thank you,
she said, holding her gloved hand out expectantly as he locked the drawers again. It was sad that he had to lock them, but obviously it was the right choice. You are really choosing some weird ways to try to make a good impression, he told Jessica, stepping around her and walking out of the door towards the conference trailer. Part of him felt bad for Jessica because, obviously, she was more than just a little distressed about her changing role. But there was more than enough work to go around in the bayou. She could thrive if she wasn't trying to swipe what she saw as the highest profile tasks. he was going to have another conversation with Sonia because Jessica was coming across as a little unhinged. An unhinged administrative assistant left unsupervised was a bad thing in the Bayou. Leonard walked into the conference room to find Zed studying a poster-sized chart pinned to the walls. Leonard had spent the better part of the day getting those printed and arranging them just so. Things were changing fast in the Bayou, and he wondered if Zed, whose family had lived here for centuries, resented the League and its impact on his home. Jillian had originally been welcomed into the town because cooperation with the League meant much-needed resources like funding for the clinic and new roads. Were those things worth potential exposure to the outside world? "Zed, what are you doing here?" Leonard asked.
"Hey, bud. Just looking at a chart of our population forecasts. Jillian asked me to join tomorrow's meeting about the issues facing the town post-Pope Lickmonster."
Zed gave Jessica a disapproving look as she walked through the door. She scowled when she saw Leonard was placing agendas in front of each seat. AJ, Jillian, Sonia, Danny, Rob, Adam, and the other department heads filed in, each giving Leonard a friendly wave. Will walked in with Charlotte and sent Sonia a very professional eyebrow wiggle from across the room. Sonia rolled her eyes as she took her seat near AJ, but she was grinning. Zed was far less professional, sweeping Danny into a kiss that belonged on the front of a romance novel, probably involving an MMA fighter. Bale had no role in this meeting whatsoever, but was hovering behind Jillian as if she could collapse or burst into flames any minute. Either one was possible, but she'd done the flame thing before, and it was always a crowd pleaser. This was one of the things he liked best about working in the Bayou, the people. Well, except for Jessica, who was the worst. He had friends here, something he'd never quite managed in his hometown in Ohio. He was contributing, making the world a better place for people, something that would have been more difficult in his original field as a geologist. Unless you managed to find an enormous secret volcano and stop it from erupting, there weren't a lot of save-the-world opportunities in geology. He'd already had at least two in this job.
"Well, glad to have you here," Leonard told Zed. "Siobhan should be delivering the pies any minute."
Leonard checked the time on his phone. Frankly, it was strange that the pies weren't there already. Even with the late notice, Siobhan always had a reserve of pies in case of a rush.
"Oh, I canceled that order," Jessica said. "Pie just seems like a heavy, messy food for an after-lunch meeting. I got a fruit plate and some gluten-free muffins instead."
Absolute silence. Every single person in the room was staring at Jessica in horror. Zed actually clutched his chest. He was having a heart attack. "What have you done?" Danny whispered.
"Do you think we come to these meetings for the fruit?"
Ivy Portnoy demanded. When AJ's brows rose, she added,
"Okay, sure, we come here for important Bayou matters and to make the world a better place, but mostly, it's the pie. I think it's the gluten-free muffins that's pushing her over the edge," Sonia murmured. "It's a healthier option," Jessica insisted. "There's no reason for the League to pay exorbitant prices for locally made pies. They're not even artisanal. I think Siobhan uses lard in her crust."
Zed leveled a look at AJ.
"We need to have a talk."
Jillian cleared her throat, struggling to keep a pleasant expression on her face.
"Leonard, please offer Siobhan our deepest apologies and assure her that order will not be changed again in the near future."
"Got it." Leonard leapt up from his chair and jogged across the street. No wonder Bathilda was so snippy with him in the pie shop earlier. She'd thought he canceled the League's regular meeting order without explanation. Siobhan met him at the door, smirking, carrying a stack of pie boxes.
Siobhan, I wouldn't have run out of here earlier if I'd known she canceled the order. I'm so sorry.
Sonia already texted, she said. Apologies accepted. Also, I had Bathilda add a 20% pain in my ass fee to the invoice.
You, text?
He asked, tilting his head as he stared at her.
I'm ancient, not outdated,
she replied, handing him the boxes.
Get with the times, Leonard.
Make it a 30% pain in the ass fee, he told her, before running back across Main Street.
He could hear her cackling behind him. He rushed into the conference room, carefully placing the boxes on the end of the table and passing out plates and napkins. Zed was mid-sentence, sounding much more like an elected official than he normally did.
We're just not ready for the numbers Dr. Ass of Aspern is projecting. We already have Droll living in an improvised RV park at the end of Main Street. Teresa's been fielding calls from businesses wanting to talk to our Chamber of Commerce. We don't have a Chamber of Commerce, lest you count the Boone family. And giving them more power is the last thing we need. No offense, Bale. Bale shrugged. And as much as we want to welcome anyone and everyone who wants to live in the bayou, we're not ready for a massive influx of new residents, Zed lamented. We don't have the infrastructure, the public works, the supply chain, the stores, anything to support a population boom like this.
If it helps, Bonita de los Santos said that several tour companies have inquired about setting up post office boxes. Tourism dollars will only help local economy, Adam noted, pulling out a chart he'd printed.
Danny cupped her hands together, a ball of light, forming between her palms. It was her usual method of dealing with Adam when he tried to take over meetings, waffling on about how he was single-handedly saving Mystic Bayou's financial future.
People want to do tours?
Zed exclaimed, shaking his head.
Do they realize how insulting that is? We're not a zoo.
Maybe instead of letting people wander through the bayou unsupervised, we arrange some sort of seminar? Jillian suggested, laying a hand on Zed's arm. Guest speakers and lectures all in one contained place, like a visitor center, where they can't do any damage and it's sort of contained.
We don't have a visitor center, Jillian, Zed replied. Or hotels or apartments to rent. And the last thing we want is for a housing development to spring up near the old rift site or something. And how do we feed all these people without running the grocery store empty every other day?
What about pop-up stores? Sonia suggested. Or helping the grocery establish delivery trucks. You know, they're a big hit in the outside world, and it would provide a much-needed service for older residents. Bale could maybe avoid pulling over poor Emily McAinsley every time she drives into town.
I think Emily and I would both appreciate that, Bale muttered. But construction takes time around here, and these temporary fixes to long-term issues are going to involve a lot of trailers. That could be a problem come hurricane season.
We need engineers, Zed said. Electrical, sewage, roads, all the things that communities need to provide for their citizens on a larger scale. We need to catch up.
So with the engineering and construction types moving to town, that's even more people, Will mused. People who will need the housing and the food and all the stuff we mentioned, plus medical care, a firehouse, a real courthouse facility. All the things you need when people get into the mishaps involved in being people. We may have to build a hospital.
Mystic Bayou can't stay the same, Danny said gently, kissing Zed's cheek. That was never an option.
But we can keep the changes from being destructive, Zed muttered. Keep the local businesses from getting run out of town. Keep the cost of living from getting so high. The families who have always lived here can't afford it anymore. We're here to help any way we can, AJ promised.
We're gonna have to add another stoplight, huh? Zed asked.
That'll make three, Bale crowed, raising his hands in triumph.
Leonard pulled his truck down the gravel drive to the Maison de Fou, a strange mishmashed house on the water that Will and Sonia were renting from the town. Called the House of Fools by the locals, it consisted of several faded blue-gray stories topped by a copper cupola, green with age. As Leonard carried his offering of flowers and a bottle of wine down the drive, he could see mason jar lanterns strung over a dock that extended from under the ground floor to the water. Guests were sprawled in a ring of comfortable-looking mismatched chairs, watching the twilight bloom. Witch bottles glowed to life in the trees, giving the small gathering a festive air. Bale had Jillian seated in a heavily cushioned Adirondack chair, rubbing her feet. Danny was perched in Zed's lap, chatting with Jillian while sipping a can of ginger ale. Will was burning something on the grill and couldn't have looked happier, while Cordelia Canton gave him pointers on proper grilling techniques. Charlotte was standing at the end of the dock, talking to Will's brother John while they drank beer. A sudden and sharp pang of jealousy speared right through Leonard's chest, and it shamed him. Charlotte seemed like the kind of lady that deserved someone like John. A selkie like his brother, who was a decent enough person to have earned Sonia's good opinion, which wasn't easy. Also, John didn't have a curse hanging over his head. Maybe fate could have been a little kinder by not pairing Charlotte with someone so brutally and sensitively handsome right in front of Leonard's face. But he'd gotten used to this sort of kick in the teeth from fate. It was the first time Leonard hadn't seen her in her sensible scrubs, and he was having a hard time not staring at her lithe figure in a floral sundress. The cool blue fabric brought out the caramel highlights in her hair and made her eyes seem even larger. She turned those eyes toward his and smiled sweetly. He dropped his gaze to the ground, the water, anything that would make it seem that he wasn't staring at her like a big creep. Step one in getting through a potentially disastrous social occasion at your boss's house, stop staring at your boss's guests.
Leonard, I'm so glad you could make it,
Sonia exclaimed as Leonard handed her the wine and flowers.
This is so sweet of you. Nice bottle, too.
Thanks for inviting me, Sonia.
Well, we really haven't had any sort of party here since we moved in. Too many near catastrophes. Besides, we had to welcome Charlotte to town properly
and make up for that nightmare meeting.
And
thank you for not inviting Jessica or AJ, even though it will probably be awkward at work tomorrow, he said quietly.
She shrugged nonchalantly, then told him, go, make yourself comfortable.
Leonard grabbed a beer from the cooler and stood on the outside of the group, just watching the interactions. It was his normal MO during parties. There were too many opportunities to spill something or knock something over. John followed Sonia inside, probably to fetch Charlotte another beer or pearls from the bottom of the sea or something super impressive and romantic. Danny announced the need to visit the ladies' room, leaving Zed to fold Cordelia into his arms and press a brotherly kiss to her forehead. Her boyfriend, Brendan, just rolled his eyes and shook his head.
I don't need to remind you that if you hurt my Cordelia, I can and will snap you like kindling Irish, Zed called.
Brendan replied with something rude in Gaelic, which Leonard didn't speak, but he knew international profanity when he heard it.
Are Zed and Cordelia related?
Charlotte asked Leonard. Leonard shook his head.
No, but he adopted her formally, or as formally as a bear can, after she moved here. There was forehead licking involved. That's all I know.
Zed seems like a very nice man, but I would like my forehead to remain unlicked.
I would say that's reasonable, he conceded. But he doesn't just go around adopting people willy-nilly. Cordelia was in desperate need of family.
Well, that's sweet of him, she said, aside from the licking. So your family, what are they like?
Haven't we already talked about my family? He replied. Pretty normal, aside from the curse. What about yours? It has to be more interesting, what with the fairy history.
This is going to sound awful, she said, cringing.
I doubt it, he said. Given my own cursed state, keep in mind that I'm in no place to judge. Charlotte's brow wrinkled as if she was trying to apologize for the words coming out of her mouth.
I tried moving back home after I graduated and working with my mother, but it didn't work out.
That was her big secret, being unable to work with her mom? Leonard shook his head. Well, yeah, working with family can be a nightmare. I worked at my dad's garage every summer from sixth grade to high school graduation. I don't think we had a civil dinner conversation in the summertime until I got my first lab job. You spend all day together and then you go home together? Little resentments build up. Things you were supposed to do and didn't. Things you wish they wouldn't do and they never seem to stop.
Yes, exactly that, she gasped, clutching his arm as if he were some sort of lifeline of understanding.
Leonard tried not to sigh from the warm sensation winding out from his arm to his chest, just under his heart. Surely, sighing in the middle of a conversation like you just slid into a hot bath would be rude and off-putting.
Don't get me wrong, Charlotte said. My parents are amazing people. They're kind and supportive, and they love me so much. So even when I moved into my own place, the phone was just ringing all the time, and anything became an excuse for me to come over to their place. By the time we were about a year into a practice together, I realized I needed some space.
The league offered me a job, and while I frequently call and video chat with my parents every Saturday, I try to limit my visits to Christmas. His eyes narrowed as he stared at her. She grimaced.
I knew that was going to sound bad.
He laughed. No, I'm just trying to figure out how you get away with it. Do you have any idea how awful holidays can be when your entire family gets more and more clumsy the more stressed out they are? We've never gotten a turkey all the way to the table. Never.
I would imagine it's pretty bad, she said, nodding. But yesterday, during that really weird meeting, you managed to run across the street without any problems while carrying a bunch of pies. It was practically a Three Stooges setup and nothing.
He scoffed. Well, yeah, but I wasn't nervous then. It wasn't my screw-up. It was Jessica's. I was just trying to fix it and help Sonia and Jillian. I love helping Sonia and Jillian. I don't get stressed out doing what I love. She grinned at him, and he actually felt his heart catch, which honestly sort of hurt. But it was worth it to know that he was the one who brought that joy to her face. She clinked her bottle against his.
I know exactly what you mean.
In that moment, Leonard decided he wanted Charlotte McBee, badly. And the thought of even trying to woo her made him very nervous. And he was in a lot of trouble.
5. Charlotte enjoyed a rare weekend morning off, cleaning the silver stork and doing her grocery shopping, securing a P.O. box from the very subtly nosy Mrs. De Los Santos, and other adulting chores. She felt very productive when she sat down for her weekly video call with her parents. Now that she'd established herself as an adult with a lot of space between her household, mobile as it was, and her parents, their relationship was a lot better. She found herself looking forward to their weekend calls. It had been freeing to talk to Leonard the night before,
and for him to understand how she felt about her family. While Will had been none too subtle in introducing Charlotte to his perfectly nice and extremely single brother, John, Charlotte had spent most of the prior evening talking to Leonard. She thought maybe that was Sonia's aim, because the more time she spent with Leonard, the happier Sonia became. But Will got glummer and glummer. When the evening wound to a close and Leonard offered to drive her back to her trailer, Sonia's smirk was almost indecent. Leonard had driven like a grandma on the winding, twisting roads back to town. But she didn't have the heart to tease him about it. She sensed that he didn't want to make some random mistake while driving and hurt her. He was trying to protect her from the consequences of his curse. It was sweet, really, like most things about Leonard. She couldn't help but watch his elegant hands moving carefully on the steering wheel and remember the way he darted across Main Street. His long legs carried him with purpose and confidence, and the memory of it had her squirming in her seat. A lot of aspects of Leonard were pretty attractive. But seeing him move like a man on a mission, even if that mission was retrieving forsaken pie, well, she was just happy to be on the receiving end of it. Charlotte wondered if he used that sort of care and determination everywhere. He'd parked far enough from the silver stork that he couldn't possibly risk hitting it. Then he carefully stepped around the car and opened her door, taking her hand and helping her out of her seat with aching slowness. She knew it wasn't particularly enlightened to get hot and bothered over being treated like spun glass, but she'd worked so hard for so long taking care of other people. And even though she loved that work, it was nice having someone take care of her. She squeezed her fingers around Leonard's as they approached her front step. "Big plans over the weekend?" he asked. "The Saturday phone call and errands," she said. "Taking Sunday as my day of rest, though I'm never really able to relax just in case someone goes into labor." "Well, you should," he said. "Relax, I mean. You can't take care of anybody if you're all drained and tired." When she smiled at him, he took both her hands in his. "When does your confinement with Jillian start?" he asked, turning those hands over and staring at them like they were something precious. "Probably next week," she said. "It all depends on Jillian, of course." "Well, I'll be in my office, unless Jessica tries to move my desk into the parking lot," he said. "If you ever want to meet for pie or take a drive out to the old rift site, I'd be happy to take you." It was the way he asked, not demanding like so many other men, but making it entirely her choice, that had her craning up to kiss him. She'd gone up on her tippy toes, and he'd still had to duck his head to meet her lips. And she could feel his mouth curving up, even as it brushed against hers. Those long arms she admired wrapped around her and lifted her just a little bit, making her laugh into his lips. "I'll call you," she told him, before turning to unlock her door.
"You don't have my number."
"Sonia gave it to me," she'd chirped.
"I love my boss."
He sighed as she popped her door open and closed it behind her. Charlotte was so caught in this memory, in the memory of how soft and warm his lips felt against hers, that she'd very nearly forgotten that she was supposed to call her parents at noon. She hit call on her video chat app and pulled her plate of boudin and rice dressing from Clarissa Barrand in front of her. So far, this was her favorite contribution from the Bayou Mamas. But she would never say so because then she would get fluttered with Tupperware from Clarissa's competition. Her mother insisted on eating lunch together during these calls, just so Lizzie knew that Charlotte was keeping body and soul together. Hank McBee's rounded, ruddy face appeared on the screen, far too close to the camera. "Hey, Daddy. All I'm seeing is forehead."
"Oh, right."
Daddy leaned away from the laptop and waved merrily.
"Hey there, shortcake. Your mama's in the shower. Misty McGee had her twins last night. Mama didn't get back until the wee hours."
Charlotte shuddered, suddenly glad to be dealing with just one baby at a time, even if the baby was part dragon.
"So how's it going in Name Redacted Bayou?"
"Very funny," she sighed. Her father had been calling her his
"the spy who delivered babies"
since she swore her parents to secrecy over her location.
"In all seriousness,
I know it's insulting to your role as a professional when I fuss over my grown daughter, but I'm worried about you, sweetheart. If you think that the mood in town is shifting, you hightail it for home.
I couldn't leave my patients, she replied. Besides, I'd be better protected here than I would be at home, with all the league resources we have here. If anything, I'd want you and Mama to come here. I don't think our neighbors are going to take too well to the idea that you and Mama have been lying to them all this time.
You let me worry about that, he said. So how are things in the eye of the storm?
It's going well. Busy. But the people are really nice. Charlotte was smiling dreamily, thinking of Leonard, before she realized it. Her daddy's brown eyes narrowed, and he grinned.
Any one person in particular?
Dang it. She never had been able to hide anything from her father. He may not have had supernatural powers, but he could sniff out a lie like a freaking bloodhound. Maybe, she said, her cheeks flushing. We've just met, so who knows?
Well, sometimes you just know. And sometimes people don't figure out they made a mistake until they're halfway down the aisle. You don't have to rush things. Hell, it took me months before I convinced your mama to go on a date with me.
Yeah, I wouldn't go around telling people that.
It was called courtship back then, Shortcake.
Mm-hmm.
Is he a nice boy?
Her father asked. He's a nice man, she replied, snickering when he pulled a disgusted face. He's perfectly sweet and downright gentlemanly.
Is he like you and Mama? Or like me?
It was a delicate question. Charlotte's grandmother hadn't been entirely thrilled with Hank as a mate for Lizzie. There had always been some hope that Lizzie would meet another Fae. But still, Grandma wanted Lizzie to be happy. And Hank made Lizzie very happy. He's human, but there are complications.
Does he have horns, like that Pope-lick monster fella?
Charlotte laughed. No, other complications. I'll talk about it when Mama gets on the call. That way I just say it all at once.
Well, speak of the devil,
he said, ducking away as a hand came into frame and lightly smacked his shoulder.
That man,
her Mama sighed as she sat at the kitchen table. Charlotte watched Daddy make her mother a mug of steaming coffee, doctored just the way she liked it, with three sugars. Daddy said you had a late night.
Oh, it was fine. Your daddy just worries if I'm out past sunset. How you settling in?
Fine, Charlotte insisted. It's a little strange. So many magique living in one place, but nice. Lizzie rolled her eyes and sipped her coffee.
What a time to be alive, eh? She's seeing someone,
Daddy called from the stove where he was frying eggs.
And he's complicated.
Thank you, Daddy, Charlotte muttered. Complicated how? Lizzie asked.
Honey, is he married? You know better.
Mama, he's not married, Charlotte laughed. Though that might be preferable. His whole line's been fae-cursed. He gets progressively more clumsy the more stressed out he gets. Apparently it ruined his career in the science labs, so now he's working as an administrator for the big muckety-mucks here in the bayou. Lizzie sat back in her chair.
Oh, that is a nasty bit of magic.
It really is.
Have you offered to remove it?
Her mother asked. Apparently, the only way to remove it was for the cursed ancestor to apologize to the girl he hurt. Which is impossible now that he's been dead for a century or two, Charlotte replied. And if anybody else tries to remove it, it will get three times worse. Lizzie frowned.
Well, the apology was the only way for the original casting fairy to remove the curse, sure. That was the condition she was allowed to apply to the magic, as the creator.
I'm sensing a but here.
Well, magic is very different for everybody, but the basic laws are still the same. You couldn't just create magic without end, echoing on forever. That's not how it works. It's like the terms and conditions in contracts. If you can apply a clause, you can remove it. That is a sad and pragmatic way to describe magic,
Daddy told her, sliding a plate of buttered toast in front of her.
It sounds like the fairy who cursed the line just wanted to make sure the family never consulted a magic practitioner to undo her work.
Leonard's family never tried to remove the curse because they were too afraid. So they stayed cursed forever. Wow, that fairy godmother was mean, Charlotte marveled.
The power of belief,
Lizzie said, jerking her shoulders and biting into her toast. And if I wanted to remove the curse, how would I do that? Her mother's expression became even more discomfited. Giving a baby a blessing only took words and good intentions. But undoing another fairy's curse? That was a totally different matter. The Popescu McBees didn't practice magic, usually. There was too much that could go wrong in the process of birthing to add the complications of ritual. But Lizzie had a treasure trove of her ancestors' books and magical tools hidden away in the attic, and she'd never shied away from learning. Charlotte, on the other hand, feared what sort of person she might become if she had shortcuts in a world that was already filled with them. So she'd left the studying to Mama, promising herself she would pick it up in a far-off someday. Someday had a way of sneaking up on people, human or fae. Lizzie chewed her toast thoughtfully.
Well, the best catch-all I know to remove curses is to counteract it with a potion made from very powerful magical ingredient. I mean the magical equivalent of turpentine. Very strong. You're going to need to base it on something with real oomph from an ancient magical creature. Hair from a unicorn's mane, a phoenix's talon, scales from the Ouroboros's tail, a dragon's eggshell.
Charlotte perked up. A dragon's eggshell?
You have access to a dragon eggshell?
Mama asked quietly. Charlotte paused, wondering how much she could say without violating patient confidentiality laws. Let's just say that I might have access to a dragon's eggshell, and the shell will have a little phoenix DNA in there too. Would that help or hurt? Lizzie nearly choked on her toast, but recovered gracefully.
Well, there's no guarantee, of course. It all depends on your intention, how the ingredients interact, and whether your subject deserves to have the curse removed in the first place. Magic is a living thing and makes judgments. It doesn't tolerate intervention on the behalf of jackasses. That's beautiful.
Daddy laid two eggs sunny side up on Mama's plate.
Is that Shakespeare? Smart ass.
Mama swatted at him, grinning as he poured her more coffee.
I'll look through the books to see if I can find a specific recipe.
Well, first I have to ask the egg owner in question if I can borrow some. How exactly am I going to phrase that?
Carefully.
Lizzie nodded, chewing her eggs.
If I find anything, I'll email it to you.
You're going to email the ancient potion recipe? Charlotte gasped. What would Granny say?
She would say shame on me for raising a pretentious Luddite for a daughter.
Thanks, Mama.
And another thing, you're going to have to tell him exactly what you're doing and what is in the potion.
Of course. I wouldn't just dose him with crushed-up dragon shell without telling him. But why?
Well, from what I can tell, it's all part of the process. People who've been cursed didn't have a choice in the matter. Choosing something different is a big part of changing it.
Noted, Charlotte said, digging into her plate of sausage.
So, do you think you might bring this boy around to meet us sometime?
Lizzie asked, far too casually. Let me try to fix it so I can get him out of the state without a catastrophe, and we'll talk. Before she could even consider raising Leonard's hopes about the potion, she had to ask Jillian to borrow a cup of mystical eggshell. But how in the hell did you even ask for that? And as most people did in the bayou when they had a strange and insurmountable task in front of them, Charlotte went to Sonia.